to be tortured eventually like the others. It was a cruel thing to say, and I said it without reflection, as young men do, only because it was what was in my mind. Yet it was true, and I was glad in some way, as I turned the key in the lock, that I had said it. We had had exultants for clients often before. Most, when they arrived, had some understanding of their situation, as the Chatelaine Thekla did now. But when a few days had passed and they were not put to torment, their hope cast down their reason, and they began to talk of release, how friends and family would maneuver to gain their freedom, and of what they would do when they were free. One would withdraw to his estates and trouble the Autarch's court no more. Another would volunteer to lead a muster of lance cadets to the north. Then the journeymen on duty in the oubliette would hear tales of hunting dogs and remote heaths and country games, unknown elsewhere, played beneath immemorial trees. The women were more realistic for the most part, but even they in time spoke of highly placed lovers, cast aside now for months or years, who would never abandon them, and then of bearing children or adopting waifs. One knew when these never-to-be-born children were given names that clothing would not be far behind, a new wardrobe on their release, the old clothes to be burned. They talked of colors, of inventing new fashions and reviving old ones. At last the time would come, to men and women alike, when instead of a journeyman with food, Master Gerlows would appear, trailing three or four journeymen and perhaps an examiner and a fulgurator. I wanted to preserve the Chatelaine Thekla from such hopes if I could. I hung Drott's keys on their accustomed nail in the wall, and when I passed the cell in which he was now swabbing blood from the floor, told him that the Chatelaine desired to speak with him. On the next day but one, I was summoned to Master Gerlows. I had expected to stand, as we apprentices usually did, with hands behind back before his table, but he told me to sit, and removing his gold-traced mask, leaned toward me in a way that implied a common cause and friendly footing.
"A week ago, or a little less, I sent you to the archivist," he said.
I nodded.
"When you brought the books, I take it you delivered them to the client yourself, is that right?"
I explained what had happened.
"Nothing wrong there. I don't want you to think I'm going to order extra fatigues for what you did, much less have you bent over a chair. You're nearly a journeyman yourself already. When I was your age, they had me cranking the alternator." "The thing is, you see, Severian, the client is highly placed."
His voice sank to a rough whisper.
"Quite highly connected."
I said that I understood that.
"Not just an Armiger family. High blood."
He turned, and after searching the disorderly shelves behind his chair, produced a squat book.
"Have you any notion how many exalted families there are? This lists only the ones that are still going. A compendium of the extinguished ones would take an encyclopedia, I suppose. I've extinguished a few of them myself."
He laughed, and I laughed with him.
"It gives about half a page to each. There are 746 pages.
I nodded to show I understood.
"Most of them have nobody at court, can't afford it, or are afraid of it. Those are the small ones. The greater families must. The Autarch wants a concubine he can lay hands on if they start misbehaving. Now, the Autarch can't play quadrille with 500 women. There are maybe 20. The rest talk to each other and dance and don't see him closer than a chain off once in a month."
I asked, trying to hold my voice steady, if the Autarch actually bedded these concubines. Master Gerlows rolled his eyes and pulled at his jaw with one huge hand.
"Well, now, for decency's sake, they have these kibits, what they call the shadow women, that are common girls that look like the Chatelaines. I don't know where they get them, but they're supposed to stand in place of the others. Of course, they're not so tall."
He chuckled.
"I said stand in place, but when they're laying down, the tallness probably doesn't make much difference. They do say, though, that oftentimes it works the other way than it's supposed to. Instead of those shadow girls doing duty for their mistresses, the mistresses do it for them. But the present Autarch, whose every deed, I may say, is sweeter than honey in the mouths of this honorable guild, and don't you forget it. In his case, I may say, from what I understand, it is more than somewhat doubtful if he has the pleasure of any of them."
Relief flooded my heart. "I never knew that. It's very interesting, Master." Master Gerlose inclined his head to acknowledge that it was indeed, and laced his fingers over his belly.
Some day you may have the ordering of the guild yourself. You'll need to know these things. When I was your age, or a trifle younger, I suppose, I used to fancy I was of exalted blood. Some have been, you know.
It struck me, and not for the first time, that Master Gerlose and Master Palamon, too, must have known whence all the apprentices and younger journeymen had come, having approved their admissions originally.
Whether I am or no, I cannot say. I have the physique of a rider, I think, and I am somewhat over the average in height, despite a hard boyhood. For it was harder, much harder, 40 years ago, I'll tell you.
So I have been told, Master.
He sighed, the kind of wheezing noise a leather pillow sometimes makes when one sits on it.
But with the passage of time, I have come to understand that the Increate, in choosing for me a career in our guild, was acting for my benefit. Doubtless I had acquired merit in a previous life, as I hope I have in this one.
Master Gerlose fell silent, looking, it seemed to me, at the jumble of papers on his table, the instructions of jurists and the dossiers of clients. At last, when I was about to ask if he had anything further to tell me, he said,
"In all my years I have never known of a member of the guild put to torment. Of them, several hundred, I suppose."
I ventured the commonplace saying that it was better to be a toad hidden under a stone than a butterfly crushed beneath it.
"We of the guild are more than toads, I think. But I should have added that though I have seen 500 or more exultants in ourselves, I have never, until now, had charge of a member of that inner circle of concubines closest to the Autarch."
"The chatelaine Thecla belonged to it? You implied that a moment ago, Master."
He nodded gloomily.
"It wouldn't be so bad if she were to be put to torment at once. But that isn't to be. It may be years. It may be never."
"You believe she may be released, Master?"
"She's a pawn in the Autarch's game with Vodalus. Even I know that much. Her sister, the chatelaine Thea, has fled the House Absolute to become his leman. They will bargain with Thecla, for a time at least, and while they do, we must give her good fare. Yet not too good."
"I see," I said. I was acutely uncomfortable, not knowing what the chatelaine Thecla had told Drott, and what Drott had told Master Gerlose.
"She's asked for better food, and I've made arrangements to supply it. She's asked for company as well, and when we told her visitors would not be permitted, she urged that one of us, at least, should keep her company sometimes."
Master Gerlose paused to wipe his shining face with the edge of his cloak. I said, "I understand." I was fairly certain that I indeed understood what was to come next.
"Because she had seen your face, she asked for you. I told her you'll sit with her while she eats. I don't ask your agreement, not only because you're subject to my instructions, but because I know you're loyal. What I do ask is that you be careful not to displease her and not to please her too much."
"I will do my best." I was surprised to hear my own steady voice. Master Gerlose smiled as if I had eased him.
"You've a good head, Severian, though it's a young one yet. Have you been with a woman?"
When we apprentices talked, it was the custom to invent fables on this topic. But I was not among apprentices now, and I shook my head.
"You've never been to the witches?" "That may be for the best. They supplied my own instruction in the warm commerce, but I'm not sure I'd send them another such as I was. It's likely, though, that the chatelaine wants her bed warmed. You're not to do it for her. Her pregnancy would be no ordinary one. It might force a delay in her torment and bring disgrace on the guild. You follow me?"
I nodded.
"Boys your age are troubled. I'll have somebody take you where such ills are speedily cured."
"As you wish, Master."
"What? You don't thank me?"
"Thank you, Master," I said.
Gerlose was one of the most complex men I have known, because he was a complex man trying to be simple. Not a simple, but a complex man's idea of simplicity. just as a courtier forms himself into something brilliant and involved, midway between a dancing master and a diplomatist, with a touch of assassin if needed. So Master Gerlose had shaped himself to be the dull creature a pursuivant or bailiff expected to see when he summoned to the head of our guild. And that is the only thing a real torturer cannot be. The strain showed, though every part of Gerlose was as it should have been, none of the parts fit. He drank heavily and suffered from nightmares. But he had the nightmares when he had been drinking, as if the wine, instead of bolting the doors of his mind, threw them open and left him staggering about in the last hours of the night, trying to catch a glimpse of a sun that had not yet appeared, a sun that would banish the phantoms from his big cabin and permit him to dress and send the journeymen to their business. Sometimes he went to the top of our tower, above the guns, and waited there, talking to himself, peering through glass, said to be harder than flint for the first beams. He was the only one in our guild, Master Palamon not excepted, who was unafraid of the energies there and the unseen mouths that spoke sometimes to human beings and sometimes to other mouths in other towers and keeps. He loved music, but he thumped the arm of his chair to it and tapped his foot, and did so most vigorously to the kind he liked best, whose rhythms were too subtle for any regular cadence. He ate too much and too seldom, read when he thought no one knew of it, and visited certain of our clients, including one on the third level, to talk of things none of us eavesdropping in the corridor outside could understand. His eyes were refulgent, brighter than any woman's. He mispronounced quite common words, urticate, salpinx, baudreau. I cannot well tell you how bad he looked when I returned to the citadel recently, how bad he looks now. Chapter 8. The Conversationalist. Next day, for the first time, I carried Thekla's supper to her. For a watch I remained with her, frequently observed through the slot in the cell door by draught. We played word games, at which she was far better than I, and after a while talked of those things those who have returned are said to say lie beyond death, she recounting what she had read in the smallest of the books I had brought her. Not only the accepted views of the Hierophants, but various eccentric and heretic theories. "When I am free," she said, "I shall found my own sect. I will tell everyone that its wisdom was revealed to me during my sojourn among the torturers. They'll listen to that." I asked what her teachings would be. "That there is no Agatha demon or afterlife, that the mind is extinguished in death as in sleep, yet more so." "But who will you say revealed that to you?" She shook her head, then rested her pointed chin upon one hand, a pose that showed off the graceful line of her neck admirably. "I haven't decided yet. An angel of ice, perhaps? Or a ghost? Which do you think best?"
"Isn't there a contradiction in that?"
"Precisely." Her voice was rich with the pleasure the question gave her. "In that contradiction will reside the appeal of this new belief. One can't found a novel theology on nothing, and nothing is so secure a foundation as a contradiction. Look at the great successes of the past. They say their deities are the masters of all the universes, and yet that they require grandmothers to defend them, as if they were children frightened by poultry. Or that the authority that punishes no one while there exists a chance for reformation will punish everyone when there is no possibility anyone will become the better for it."
I said, "These things are too complex for me."
"No, they are not. You're as intelligent as most young men, I think. But I suppose you torturers have no religion. Do they make you swear to give it up?"
"Not at all. We've a celestial patroness and observances, just like any other guild."
"We don't," she said. For a moment she seemed to brood on that. "Only the guilds do, you know, and the army, which is a kind of guild. We'd be better off, I think, if we did. Still, all the days of feast and nights of vigil have become shows, opportunities to wear new dresses. Do you like this?" She stood and extended her arms to show the soiled gown.
"It's very pretty," I ventured. "The embroidery, and the way the little pearls are sewed on."
"It's the only thing I have here. What I was wearing when I was taken. It's for dinner, really. After late afternoon, and before early evening."
I said I was sure Master Gerlose would have others brought if she asked.
"I already have. And he says he sent some people to the House Absolute to fetch them for me, but they were unable to find it.
Which means that the House Absolute is trying to pretend I don't exist. Anyway, it's possible all my clothes have been sent to our chateau in the north, or one of the villas. He's going to have his secretary write them for me.
Do you know who he sent?
I asked. The House Absolute must be nearly as big as our citadel, and I would think it would be impossible for anyone to miss.
On the contrary, it's quite easy. Since it can't be seen, you can be there and never know it, if you're not lucky. Besides, with the roads closed, all they have to do is alert their spies to give a particular party incorrect direction, and they have spies everywhere. I started to ask how it was possible for the House Absolute, which I had always imagined a vast palace of gleaming towers and domed halls, to be invisible. But Thekla was already thinking of something else altogether, stroking a bracelet formed like a crocken whose tentacles wrapped the white flesh of her arm. Its eyes were cabochon emeralds. They let me keep this, and it's quite valuable. Platinum, not silver. I was surprised.
There's no one here who can be bribed.
It might be sold in Nessus to buy clothing. Have any of my friends tried to see me? Do you know Severian?
I shook my head. They would not be admitted.
I understand, but someone might try. Do you know that most of the people in the House Absolute don't know this place exists?
I see you don't believe me. You mean they don't know of the Citadel?
They're aware of that, of course. Parts of it are open to everyone, and anyway you can't miss seeing the spires if you get down into the southern end of the living city, no matter which side of Jael you're on. She slapped the metal wall of her cell with one hand. They don't know of this, or at least a great many of them would deny it still exists.
She was a great, great chatelaine, and I was something worse than a slave, I mean in the eyes of the common people who do not really understand the functions of our guild. Yet when the time had passed and Drott tapped the ringing door, it was I who rose and left the cell and soon climbed into the clean air of evening, and Thekla, who stayed behind to listen to the moans and screams of the others,